Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thanks for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Matt Kinnear and Christian Sweezy, and we are going to be bringing you an overdose of D1 lacrosse fall ball recap action. We're coming back to the podcast for the first time since the end of the MLL season. We appreciate you joining us. Hopefully you're filling up your brain with a little bit of lacrosse knowledge heading into Thanksgiving travel season. And you know, a lot of what we're going to talk about is going to be true all throughout the holiday season. So hopefully this will be something that you're going to enjoy. Basically, over the next three podcasts, we're going to do a three-parter. We'll go kind of conference by conference, team by team, about, you know, kind of the reason that I asked Christian and Matt to do this is because Christian wrote the top 20 capsule previews for Face Off Yearbook. Matt basically conducted and in many instances wrote the 17 fall ball all access write-ups. And as a result, extensive fall coverage, a lot of conversations, a lot of reading, a lot of seeing, covering some of the events as well. What went on all throughout Division I college lacrosse over the last month, particularly you know, during the month of October. So, first of all, fellas, thanks a lot for joining me. Really
sure.
Appreciate
thanks for having me.
Your
thanks
time.
For having me too.
This is going to be awesome. So, before we dive in, and we will give you a little bit of a breakdown of what's to come. But before we dive in, you know, Christian, you just brought up an interesting point before we hit the record button, and that is kind of what is the future of fall ball. And you know, over the last 5, 6, 7 years since I've been working at Inside Lacrosse, we've seen a little bit of I don't want to say disintegration, but the types of a proliferation of the major charitable events, but it's kind of like eaten into the big 8-10 team play days. More frequently this fall, we saw four or five Division I teams in a certain location, and you know, with even greater consistency than in the past, a lot of teams not playing outside varsity opponents. What are your thoughts on what that means for what this fall went and how this fall went, and what's next for fall ball, maybe what we'll see in 2014?
They always say that coaches are the biggest copycats, and it's interesting to me that Duke, which traditionally does not do outside scrimmages in the fall, and Duke has won 2 of the past 4 national titles, and I'm wondering what sort of model, if that is a model, sort of going forward. And to me, what caught my eye was Maryland not doing a fall event this year. You know, they're obviously in a hotbed of places. They could have gone to the event at the Lannan School for the George Boyardi Foundation when Cornell dropped out, and they, you know, they had very legitimate reasons for not doing so. I think there was another event that Maryland could have parachuted into and decided not to. And it was interesting, Matt, when you and I were at their practice early in fall ball, one of the things John Tillman, the coach, said was we are actually, in the fall, when you have an event, you tend to sort of build toward that event. When you don't have an event, every day tends to be have its own sort of sense of urgency. And he had sort of liked the pace of fall ball without building up to a big set of scrimmages against other teams. And I'm curious, you know, if Maryland hits a home run this year, having not done fall ball with a bunch of freshmen on offense, who you would think it would behoove them to have done fall ball, I'm curious if that's going to be a copycat and people see Duke and people see the Maryland model of not doing much in the fall, then that would be something other programs would be interested in. And there's a practical side, too, because the NCAA limits participation dates to 17, and that includes the fall. So I think Maryland, that was one reason Maryland was very reluctant to do those events in the fall, was because they want that extra game in the spring or think they might need it with the ACC schedule. So I think there's a practical side to it, but I also think there's a sort of legitimate copycat side to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Maryland, I think, is kind of the most interesting case this year. You know, last year, I think it was pretty evident from everybody that team just burnt out, you know, as you got 3/4 of the way through the season. You know, a scrimmage in the fall, can you really say that that's the reason why? Probably not. But, you know, I think kind of on a next level of this fall schedule thing, you know, they tried to make it more fun and about less about, you know, competing against other teams and about kind of bonding as a team together. And, you know, I think they were just wired too tightly last year. And by not having the scrimmage, it kind of allowed them to kind of stay in their own world, you know, not have the pressure of, you know, goals and assists in an intercollegiate, you know, competition. And, you know, maybe try to spread out, you know, kind of their best play throughout the whole season as opposed to, you know, going too hard too early.
Well, and one of the things about fall play that is interesting to me and I think is a little bit cyclical because of the World Games cycle is the opportunity to play national teams. We saw a handful of teams in New England play the English national team when they came through. Obviously the Iroquois, I think the Israel team scrimmaged a couple of varsity opponents. And traditionally the U.S. national team, plays one event in the fall and then plays another event at the end of January. Duke has been in a part of that. Notre Dame has been a part of that in the past. So those games don't count as actual contests. And it's interesting. You can get a lot out of those in terms of the film, the critiques with your players, all the things that you want to get out of a scrimmage without sacrificing an additional game. And as you said, Duke has been an early adopter of playing a lot of regular season games, almost treating their early season games maybe as scrimmages. Maybe that's one of the reasons we've seen them get out to 2-4 and 3-3 starts over the last couple seasons. But it's one of those things that next year there might not be as many opportunities to play these national team games. Maybe you see alumni games kind of slide into those opportunities. I don't know. I think it's a little too early to say that there's going to be a dramatic shift one way or the other, but it's definitely something to keep an eye on. Sticking with the thematic idea to kind of frame the conversation over the course of these next three podcasts, a couple of things that we're going to touch on, pay particular attention to as we go team by team through five conferences, roughly about 25 to 30 teams, is just the overall trends of what people like to see, hear about, read about, talk about in the fall. I think that when we kind of discuss this, a couple things come to the forefront. Guys that are returning from injuries, missed either the end of or all of the previous season, big coaching moves, either head coaches or assistant coaches, and guys that'll make significant system changes, culture changes. A lot of times those types of system changes are very interesting. Sometimes they're not associated with a coaching move. Players changing positions. Just examples of these are flying through my head as we go through, just think back in the last couple of years. Transfers, high-profile recruits as they get in. This year, because there are four new programs, I think the way that they conducted their business in the fall is of particular interest as well, and we'll get to those four programs at the end of this podcast. But for the meat of the matter, let's dive into the ACC. Six teams this year and only this year as Notre Dame and Syracuse join as full members, Maryland in their last year before departing to the Big Ten. And, guys, I kind of want to limit this as much to fact as possible. I want to make this conversation the type of trust tree type situation where you don't feel silly saying, I don't know. I feel like in my 6 years at Inside Lacrosse, this is a fall that I was as disconnected with as any, having gotten married and then being out of the country for a couple weeks. So now I'm going to rely on you for a lot of information. It's a little bit of a bummer that we're starting with the ACC. Obviously, they're incredibly high profile with all six teams being legitimate national title contenders. But because of our location in the Mid-Atlantic and their location kind of scattered throughout the country, not so much being as coastal as they might once have been, we didn't get eyes on these teams nearly as much. We already talked about Maryland and Duke. Duke did scrimmage Furman, but Maryland not playing in outside competition. So, to a degree, with the exception of the Terps, I got an opportunity to see Notre Dame scrimmage Air Force in Colorado. This is going to be a lot of conversational-based information. Doesn't make it any less interesting or important or compelling because, after all, we're professional reporters. But let's start with the defending national champions. And, Christian, I'll toss it to you in the first place. We've already kind of discussed their approach towards fall ball. One thing that I think is significant about this fall ball as compared to last year is that, Matt Tanowski has a year under his belt as a full-time assistant coach, having replaced Chris Gabrielli. The staff has a little bit more cohesion. So to a degree, they got to deal with being national champions, defending national champions. So, John Donowski has been in this situation before. He knows how to do it. What's your sense of kind of how he's tackling the attitude of both, making sure that there isn't the complacency that comes with, the satisfaction of having won the year prior and also a little bit more continuity and consistency in the coaching staff?
I was very fortunate to talk to John Donowski, and of course, because they're the defending champion, I may have talked to one or two coaches about Duke as well. That may have come up a couple times in the fall. They're interesting to me. It was Brendan Fowler, the great face-off guy, who had not done a fall ball for very different reasons previously. He'd been on the football team, but this year he was with the lacrosse team. I said, oh, that's great. You get Fowler, for fall ball. And John says, yeah, but he didn't take any face-offs. He didn't take any face-offs last fall, and he was great, so why change it? What they do in the fall is so interesting to me. you know, one year he had the guys practice, the long sticks, everyone had to practice with a short stick, goalies, long sticks, you know, and he just said, well, we needed to work on footwork, you know, another year they do yoga. There's always, you know, it's not the same thing with them. There's always some kind of wrinkle that he throws in there. And I agree to your point, Terry, that you said earlier about the 2-4 and 3-3 starts. I think Chontanowski is a guy who always gives the senior players a first shot. And I think that, you know, it's much easier to do that in the regular season than in the fall. And he's, you know, they've had fifth-year transfers from Harvard come in and start an attack, and then midway through the season they'll change it up. But he gives those guys, right of first refusal, so to speak. And I really respect that about his program, that it isn't lip speak. You know, if you're a senior and you've put in your time, he's going to give you the shot. And if it doesn't work out, then the younger guys come in and play. But that's one of the things about Duke that has always interested me. And one of the things about Chontanowski is that he doesn't live and die every Saturday, you know, in the season. He's building toward May, and they've been very good in May. I had a guy whose opinion I really respect a couple weeks ago email me, and he said, I think Chontanowski's a Belichick-type genius. And I, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, that's probably more right than wrong. You know, I had always thought of him as sort of loosey-goosey, but there is such a method to his structure and his madness that, to me, it's fascinating.
Absolutely. Matt, you know, Pete Kutrampas did the All-Access write-up from Durham, and checking that out this morning, it seemed like, you know, for what maybe it lacked in detail in terms of analyzing on-field play, to Christian's point, not really that big of a deal at Duke. Number one, they return so much talent. We kind of all know what we're going to get out of them. Number two, what they lose, kind of leadership from their midfield. And tremendous production as well. That's not to be mistaken. You know, with Lawson, Trapuka, and Offit gone, that's obviously, you know, a place where they need to fill some holes. However, with those three guys gone, anybody that saw interviews with Dave Lawson and Jake Trapuka last year know what sizable personalities those guys were. It seemed like, you know, Pete focused a little bit more on the leadership and how he felt like that was coming to fruition. Did you get anything in terms of a sense, just kind of checking that out, or just kind of what your impressions are of Duke generally?
It's interesting. Like, he really is the, you know, kind of the wizard in the coaching ranks. You know, the funny thing is kind of, this speaks to Christian's point, the one thing in that piece that people, you know, our readers kind of latched onto was Danowski saying that none of the freshmen carry the nets. You know, the seniors carry the nets to practice every day in the fall because, you know, they kind of want to make the seniors big brothers to the freshmen as opposed to, you know, some powerful, you know, force above them. That's like the one thing that people really latched onto when we did this fall piece. And it kind of speaks to, you know, just their mentality and, you know, their seniors, like you said, are going to get the chance, but, you know, toward the season, they want, the middle of the season, if the freshmen are better, they're going to, you know, get their shot to play. So that's amazing. And another thing that, you know, kind of one of the first comments is, you know, I posted this on Facebook, and I mentioned something about, you know, how great Danowski was of a coach and what he does in the fall and how it pays dividends. And one of the first comments was, well, that's why they always are so bad at the beginning of the season, because they don't you know, do a proper fall ball, so to speak. So it's kind of, what do you think? Like, starting off the season, is that really so bad when you win national championships? I don't think so.
I think it's incredibly functional. I think that he has identified not only it's not bad to lose games early, but it might be good. You get more of your players' attention. And I always, you know, people that don't lose sight of the fact that the goal is winning a championship realize that it's important to be playing your best at the end of the season. And there's only so much that you can do in the beginning of the season to make sure that you're playing your best at the end of the season. And one of the things is trying to keep your players as focused for 4 months as you possibly can. And I think losing makes it easier to keep their focus.
And one thing when you speak to leadership, you know, one thing that I think has to be mentioned is with Matt Danowski being there another year and just kind of his leadership as, you know, we see him on the field in the MLL and what he does and just, you know, him kind of growing as a coach, I think is more important than maybe we put some stock in sometimes.
Well, let's move on to Syracuse. They were, you know, a handful of goals away from a national championship themselves after entering the season last year as, I think, expected to be a good, maybe not great team. This year, it seems as if, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, some of the choices that they made were directly a result of trying to get over that last hump, that last hurdle. You know, obviously they lost some big personalities in JoJo Marasco and Brian McGill, but specifically, what are your thoughts on the fact that they have 55 players in their fall practices, and they were really slugging it out at the faceoff X? I'm not sure how many of those guys were faceoff specialists, but more than there were last year is my sense, with a couple of guys transferring in and a couple of guys transferring out. Like we said, nobody on this podcast had an opportunity to get a look at the Orange, but certainly, like we've said, there are a lot of conversations. Christian, what are your thoughts just on those two choices in particular, the big roster, at least for the fall, and how they're addressing their face-off issues?
I remember Dave Ramey's piece where he said it was almost like being at a football practice. There were so many guys, and you mentioned the 55 on the fall roster, and we think there's a couple who are coming for the spring season, so you know they certainly had a lot of numbers. I mean, obviously the face-off stuff, they would seem to have almost everything else in place. Certainly their attack and midfield looked fantastic. The defense you would expect would be good with Mullins coming back healthy after his torn ACL goal. They have depth. Face-offs, obviously, that's not a small consideration, especially with Fowler coming back from Duke and other teams. You know, North Carolina, who Syracuse now has to play this year, is very good on face-offs, and that's clearly something that they're focused on, but to me, that what's interesting is that they must think the other pieces are there because they spent so much time on face-offs. You know, I think that they're going to be pretty good.
I guess, Matt, the other thing that struck out to me is, you know, Sweezy said they've got a lot of talent coming back offensively, a lot of talent coming in offensively. A lot of those guys are attackmen. So let's just do this: Nicky Glasso, Derek Maltz, incoming freshman Dylan Maltz, Kevin Rice and Dylan Donahue. 50-point scorers last year. Billy Ward, man-up specialist. He was a top recruit, always going to be in the mix. Mike Daniello, Hopkins transfer, has started in his career as a Blue Jay, missed last season because of injury. Freshman Matt Lane was one of the first guys that Ramey mentioned in his piece because he's so big and he's going to have some sort of presence. Not to mention Jordan Evans, the number one recruit who will probably play midfield but can play attack, and Randy Statz, the OCC transfer who still needs to arrive on the hill. I mean, it's like 10 guys. How are they going to get this many guys in the field? And do you have any sense of how they try to handle that in the fall?
I mean, it's a good problem to have. You know, I think if there's any problem that you want to have, it's having more talent than not having enough talent. You know, and I think that's the key is what you mentioned is about having guys who can play midfield and attack and just putting the best guys out there. You know, the thing that we saw last year with Syracuse and maybe kind of in the past few years is this quick-moving offense that it's not relying on one guy dodging and trying to get to the net. It's a lot of ball movement. And just as many guys as you can have who are capable of kind of filling in more of a system than an individual, I mean, the better.
I like the point about they have a lot of attackmen or natural attackmen. You look at a team like Villanova. I know I'm jumping a little bit into the Big East rather than the ACC, but Villanova has
the closest thing to their offense.
Yeah, exactly. Villanova ideally has six attackmen who played attack in high school on the field because, wow, these are two guys who have seen long sticks their whole careers and suddenly have seen short sticks. And I think, too, with Syracuse and John Desco agreed, you know, the things last year that really jumped out about Syracuse, especially late in the season, once they found out their personnel, was A, that they shared the ball incredibly well, and B, their spacing was incredibly good. You know, they were used to make those little bit longer passes, and they could share the ball, and especially a team like Notre Dame, you know, Syracuse beat them pretty good twice because they could share the ball because their spacing was so good, and I think a lot of that is because you have attackmen who pass the ball a lot rather than middies who tend to shoot the ball a lot.
And one last point on that, in terms of the big roster, when you have that many attackmen, you can run full field scrimmages with two units at each end of the field that are basically a starter quality going against your defense, and I got to imagine that both defenses, the first team defense and the second team defense for Syracuse, benefited as a result.
And goalies.
And the goalies, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Seeing quality shots. Well, continuing on down the ACC train, jump to North Carolina. Had a little bit of an interesting issue with, you know, certainly they were going to have a big hole to fill at the attack with Marcus Holman having graduated. You know, I've made no secret about how big a fan of his I am, both of his game and what he brought to the team off the field. And then Jimmy Bitter doesn't practice in the fall due to an injury and rehabilitation. So Joey Sankey carrying the load. What do you think?
I mean, Joey Sankey, he kind of carried the load in that Ohio State game, that's for sure. You know, Ty Zanders was at that game and read his stuff, and they were just such a good transition team against Ohio State in that game that you know, it's kind of, from what Ty relayed to me, it's scary how good they are and how smooth they were in this portion of the season. You know, they're kind of playing their transition like it was, you know, mid-March as opposed to in September. I mean, they're going to be a scary team. How many recruiting classes have they had in the top five in the past few years? You know, Holman is obviously tough as nails, so that's kind of where I have my doubts, is it losing that mentality from a guy like Holman. Not so much the talent, but just, you know, his hard nose, his ability to just get knocked down and get right back up. Is there going to be a guy who can kind of take that over?
For me, the best college lacrosse captain, he almost deserves his own categories, Bray Malfrist from UVA when they won the title in 11, and I don't think Holman was that far off from a Malfrist type leadership and you know, possibly a program changing sort of culture, you know, within the program. But, and please remember, I voted Carolina number one in my preseason or very way too early end of season rankings, so I am a fan of what they're doing. But the two things I have my eye on, one is that Joe Brescia has said all along, give me 4 years, give me an entire program of my recruits. He's got that. Now what? And the second thing is, how hard, will it be hard at all? I should say, you know, if they make it to the, they haven't been to the Final Four since 93. Is it, can a program that loses in the quarterfinals, if they even reach that far for the past 20 years, suddenly make that leap to get to Memorial Day, suddenly do a Saturday to Monday turnaround, having never done it before? You know, certainly the pieces are there. I think the coaching is there. The talent is certainly there. But are the intangibles there? And I think they're going to be very interesting to watch this year.
And those are the types of things you don't learn in fall ball.
Right.
It almost feels like there wasn't as much that we were going to take away from this. You know, they brought in some talented players. You know, Stephen Kelly was a guy that at one point was probably the number one recruit in his class, U19 player, the youngest U19 player, the only one in this academic year at least. You know, and aside from that, Duncan Hutchins returning from injury after missing last season, I think, was a little interesting. They lost a couple transfers, guys that we'll get to, you know, Brian Sherlock, Brian Sullivan. But at the same time, you know, I liked what we saw out of them defensively. You know, I think that Evan Connell is that tough nose player. I mean, granted, he's a sophomore defenseman. You know, how much can you rely on a sophomore defenseman? But, you know, on the flip side, you mentioned, you know, the recruiting classes, Matt, and certainly that bears true, but it's interesting to me, you know, how many of these guys that are contributors weren't necessarily the most high-profile recruits in their class, you know, and some of the guys that were higher profile just haven't blossomed the way maybe they were expected to. And, you know, a guy like Will Campbell and TJ Kemp, you hope maybe that as seniors they can, you know, make their final contribution, whereas a guy like Ryan Creighton, a classmate of theirs who wasn't as big, as highly touted of a recruit, has been a consistent presence for them over the course of the last two or three seasons.
And I will say, I asked a current Division I head coach to play defense in college, which one recruit of the incoming freshmen he didn't get that he wanted, and he mentioned Austin Pafani from UNC, along Sikmidi, I guess, really good takeaway guys. So they certainly have some freshmen who I think will play significant roles.
And on to the Virginia Cavaliers, Chris LaPierre coming back. You know, he was ready to go before the season started, or before the fall season started, that is. Had an opportunity to try out for the U.S. national team. I saw him play there. He looked good athletically, looked rusty lacrosse-wise, and didn't necessarily measure up to get invited to the next round of things. But, you know, ultimately for his Virginia season, that might end up being a beneficial thing. You know, one of the things that I think people around the program gave you impression of all through last season was just losing him. You know, it was shades of Rob Pinnell in 2011 with Cornell. It was the question of whether or not he was going to return was, you know, a lingering tough pill to swallow. And then on top of that, once he was ruled to be done for the season, it was just deflating. And, you know, coming back, having him in the fall, I have to imagine it was at least an infusion of energy. But on the flip side of that, now he's a year older than the seniors and he's a dominant personality. Did either of you talk to anybody at Virginia that addressed, you know, kind of what that dynamic was like?
A little bit. I talked to Dom for Face Off Yearbook, and I talked to some of the people who had seen them out in San Francisco. And I thought it was interesting, a lot of players not a captain. That was sort of the first thing that caught my eye. And I had an assistant coach, a D1 assistant, say the same thing. And maybe that's good. Maybe he's sort of the de facto captain, or maybe he's, you know, I assume he's going to play a very significant role leadership-wise. The fact he's not an official captain, it caught my eye. I can't say if it was good or bad, but it certainly caught my eye.
Well, to just draw my example a little further, I don't think Pinnell was a captain. Or was he a captain this year? Was he a solo?
Yes, he was. I think he was.
Different approach.
Yes.
So they'll be good. I saw the film from San Francisco. As I say, I talked to Dom after San Francisco. I talked to people who'd seen them out there. And Jimmy, speaking of Pinnell, Jimmy Pinnell looks a real player. He looks like he can do a lot of different things. Pretty strong dodger, two hands. You know, I'm excited to see Zed Williams play. I think they have a lot of, and I'm curious to see about their sense of urgency. I'm also curious about the new D coordinator. You know, I think John Walker did a lot of stuff for that program that was a little bit under the radar. And you know, is there an upgrade there last year to this year? I don't know. I'm not saying no, but I'm saying I don't know.
One of the things about Carolyn Darty's All-Access that really impressed me, to your point about James Pinnell, was how much emphasis Starja put on Pinnell in order for Virginia to be good. Did you get a sense of that too, Matt?
Yeah, it was kind of startling how much, you know, for a young player, you know, Starja was asked, you know, right up front, what is the one key to your success? And James Pinnell is the one key to the success for Virginia this year. That's a lot of pressure for a young guy. You know, going back to your point about LaPierre getting hurt last year and, you know, him eventually having to sit out the rest of the year, LaPierre, coupled with their other injuries, including Pinnell, was just absolutely deflating for that team. You get the sense that Starja was so proud of his team last year, just for how they attempted to battle through that and didn't, you know, despite everything being against them. But like you said, not just having your one marquee player go down, but all these other pieces that are integral to your team go down as well, that's just absolutely deflating for any team.
And the stuff that LaPierre does, you know, he's a one-man clear, he's a wing on face-offs, he's your biggest, strongest guy. I'll never forget talking to Navy guys the year they played up at Colgate in like 06, I think it was. And, you know, Navy coming off two huge years in 04 and 05, went up to Colgate, and their toughest player, Tommy Wallen, a midfielder, like popped his ankle in practice the day before and was, you know, injured. And the guys were like, holy smokes, he's like our toughest guy, and he's hurt, and he's screaming in pain. Or maybe it was even during the warm-ups before the game started, and it was this freezing day, and Colgate won 6-3. And I remember just sort of the shock those guys were like, oh my God, Tommy Wallen can actually get hurt, you know? And I wonder if LaPierre was the same thing, like, oh my God, this guy's indestructible. How did he get hurt? And I think that, as you say, you know, Terry, your point too about is he coming back? Isn't he coming back? You know, it's very much like Pinnell and 11 where the Cornell just didn't know, or if they did, they weren't telling anyone.
A couple other interesting things about newcomers for Virginia to touch on. Joe Lisicki, a guy who missed all last season for Lynchburg, but it was a relatively unique type of player at the D3 level. What impressed me about him is how much he was a ball-in-his-stick type of long stick midi, and yet he's enormous. He's like 6'3", and he's not slim. You know, he's not one of those 6'3 guys that is like 180 pounds. He's got some weight behind him as well. It'll be interesting to see how he kind of meshes with Scott McWilliams, who's not necessarily a ball-in-his-stick type of player, but is very athletic. So you can kind of see them heading upfield together and making life difficult in transition for opposing transition offenses. You mentioned Zed Williams. He's probably the freshman player that I'm most excited to see, probably the guy for whom you would expect the competition level to be the most significant jump, you know, out of the guys that are at that level of quality recruit. You know, one bit of news that I'm pretty sure came out from the fall that was a little disappointing is Andrew Mullen, a Canadian defenseman that people were very excited about. Looks like he's not going to be able to continue going forward with his lacrosse career due to injuries. So, you know, just kind of another one of those bombers from Charlottesville. But a lot to pay attention to, a lot to be excited about if you're a Cavalier fan. And, you know, one of the things about looking back on the 2013 season that, you know, the question to me is, was Virginia really that bad, or did the season just unfold in a way where, you know, maybe contrast it with Loyola in 2012 where everything kind of went right. Last year for Virginia, everything kind of went wrong. I don't know if it's, you know, they're that far away from being as good as they want to be.
Absolutely. And this, and, you know, we've talked a lot about their offense, but this defense is really going to be fantastic and probably the strength of this team. Tanner Scales just had an excellent season, you know, in his kind of rookie year. And him a year older, McWilliams being the good leader back there, adding in Lisicki, that's really going to be a strong unit.
Moving on to Maryland, the Terps trying to get back to a national championship game for the third time in 4 years. And Matt, you made a comment earlier in the podcast that I want to come back to. You mentioned that it felt like practice was just more fun. What was that all about?
Yeah, it seemed, I've gone to Maryland practice for 3 years now in fall ball, and it's always a sense of this team that they were a little high strung and that so singularly focused on winning a national championship that, and this kind of speaks to something that Christian said earlier, that the day-to-day maybe wasn't where it should be. You know, maybe they had kind of these goals in mind that are so big and so far off that I think it was kind of weighed on the team, and you saw that later in the season, especially last year. You know, this year was fun. They made everything a competition, but a fun competition. Nico Amato, I thought, did a great job of joking around with the new guys, you know, making some jokes. They were laughing at him when he was finishing last in some of the sprints. He was laughing at the freshmen when, you know, they had some bad shots. You know, that's just stuff I didn't see in the past 2 years at Maryland. And, you know, Tillman kind of said, when we asked him the question, he said, yeah, you know, it's something we're trying to do, make it a little more fun, a little more relaxed, but also competitive in that same regard. You know, I think it's a good approach for them. I think they really needed it. I think last year really showed that they were just kind of so high-strung, and as soon as one thing didn't go their way, they didn't have the resiliency to kind of bounce back from that.
Susie, do you have any thoughts on why they might have made that choice?
Not necessarily. One thing that struck me was that, and I'm not on Twitter. I have an addictive personality. Trust me, if I get on Twitter, I will never get off it. So I'm not on Twitter. But I noticed on Twitter when I was looking for details of the Maryland alumni game, which was very late in October, vis-a-vis all the other participation days we had, was that two or three days after the Maryland alumni game, there was a Twitter post from the Maryland lacrosse saying, oh, we had a great time in the sand pit doing these sand pit workouts. Like, that doesn't sound like, you know, and I mean, I get that it's unconventional in that sense, maybe it's fun, but I was surprised that they were still going at it that hard after the alumni game. I would have thought that things had ended at the alumni game. That caught my eye, I have to admit. That impressed me a little bit. Like, you know, maybe that alumni game wasn't the end of their fall, and they kind of were going to, you know, go that little extra step.
You mentioned, well, obviously, I'm building on the heels of the alumni game, and also the funness, the factor, or the one, I guess, kind of wild card factor of the practice that you guys attended. Jeremy Sieverts was there.
Yeah.
How did he kind of, you know, it's always been interesting to me, like, how you can imagine how maybe the top-tier seniors and juniors, regular starters, maybe guys that compete for All-America type honors, those guys can compete against MLL world team type players. But what did Sieverts look like going up against, you know, third, fourth string guys? And you know, how did it seem like he kind of integrated into the practice? Because that just kind of took me by surprise to read about that.
It was funny because, you know, how he integrated into practice, I don't think any of us noticed it at the beginning. I think it, you know, was probably halfway through practice where we were like, hey, who's this guy without a number on his pinny? You know, he looks pretty sharp out there. And, you know, lo and behold, it's Jeremy Sieverts. You know, he was prepping for the Team USA tryouts and, you know, I think it was cool. It was fun. You know, I think Tillman spoke to how, you know, obviously the alumni base in Maryland is so fantastic and, you know, such good examples for them. Sieverts especially is one of those guys who had to kind of work hard to get where he is as a player. So it was cool. He integrated right in, like, you know, like just like he was any other player.
What struck me, I remember in 1998, actually at Byrd Stadium, for an NCAA quarterfinal between Hopkins and Maryland, and Maryland won in overtime. And Dick Adell had said afterward, yeah, well, we had, you know, A.J. Hogan was at Hopkins, and I think Dan Denahan. And he said, well, we had Frank Radin come in and be A.J. Hogan, and, you know, a guy who had graduated, and they had Todd Evans come in and be someone else, be Denahan, I guess. And so they, you know, that's a long, sort of, in a way, I was like, are you allowed to do that? But I guess you are. But, you know, I thought, so the fact I heard that in the Shadow Bird Stadium brought me back to 1998 about Jeremy Sieverts and the role that the alumni play. But I thought it was pretty interesting, and I was impressed that Sieverts was very humble. Like, he wasn't trying to, you know, he obviously had work he wanted to do, but I was grateful in a way to see that he was very, he deferred. You know, he wasn't first in line, for instance, for all the drills. You know, I think he kind of understood where he was. But I'm curious if this is going to be something that we might see from time to time. You know, hey, we're playing RJ Keenan at Carolina, can we borrow Andy Corno, you know, for Georgetown? Not that they play, because I don't think they do, but just sort of that example. It's a little bit of a gray area that I'm not sure I necessarily like, and I think that these coaches might possibly, out of the goodness of their heart, want to help these alumni stay in shape and bring them out to practice now and again, I'll put it that way. But I'm curious if we see any more of this going forward, and if the NCAA decides to step in. They don't now. Obviously, there's no rules against it, but I suspect we might see some rules if this gets abused.
That'd be wild. That'd be awesome. Yeah. I mean, I'd be cool. I'd be cool with breaking that type of scandal every once in a while. you know, kind of last thing I wanted to get your thought on, Christian, being outside of the office, not a guy that comes in to here every day and gets entrenched in our ridiculous recruiting conversations. you were probably taking a look at the hype of this incoming class at Maryland from a little bit more of a average fans type of perspective, you know, not necessarily having to be a part of making all the decisions. What were your thoughts on just kind of how they manifested themselves in the first fall? Those being, you know, particularly Rambo, Canizero, Rotans, Heacock, and then a guy that I think has kind of been lost in the mix a little bit in terms of offensively, Gradinger.
What impressed me, I talked to someone who had been at the Maryland alumni game, and they had said Maryland was very up-tempo. You know, they really, on offense, they ran and they ran and they ran. And what caught my eye, and I think, Matt, you too, Heacock looks like a really good athlete between the lines. You know, Canizero is clearly a good athlete between the lines. Rambo makes good decisions with the ball, maybe not an athlete per se, but a smart player, a very smart lacrosse IQ. So I think that they will, you know, if they do go up-tempo, and that's what they did in the alumni game, it would be certainly a little bit of a different look for Maryland.
And all the players that we did talk to at the fall practice, you know, without any prodding, talked about how they wanted to play up-tempo. You know, I wonder if we're going to see that out of Maryland this year, if they have the personnel to kind of make that little bit of a shift. And, you know, speaking of Rambo, the thing that struck me at practice, I didn't see anything or hear anything from the alumni game, was it just looks so easy for him. He's just kind of, it almost looks like he's disinterested. And I don't mean that as a knock on him. I mean that as just, it's just so effortless, and the ball gets to him, and he just makes the right decision. There's no, you know, it doesn't look like he's struggling, or, you know, the wheels aren't turning in his head. It just, the ball gets to him, and a good decision happens.
Yeah, I agree. And if you're playing up tempo, you want a guy who's going to make those right decisions. What struck me was, we go back to the coaches or copycats. I remember Charlie Toomey saying in 2012 that he had to bite his tongue. You know, I think he bit a hole through his tongue sometimes because they were playing up tempo and they weren't always the best decision makers, but it worked. It turned out fine. They won the national title, and Charlie and John are good friends. I'm curious if this is sort of another way, another coach saying, you know what, we're going to go up tempo and we're going to have to bite our tongue. I think Hopkins is trying something similar, and you know, it's one thing to say we're going to bite our tongue in October when we make a mistake. It's another thing in the third quarter of the Carolina game when you turn it over twice in a row and they lead to two goals for Carolina, and now you've got to face off against Archie Keenan. Are you still going to bite your tongue? Are you still going to go up tempo or not? I think the proof will be in the pudding, but it's certainly something very interesting going forward to keep an eye on.
Well, and to that end, you know, one of the things that I recall from talking to John Tillman in the winter of 2011, after the 2011 Syracuse Maryland game, where he was so roundly criticized for having stalled, and he told me, we didn't game plan to stall. We just didn't get any good looks because we weren't athletic enough. If, with this recruiting class and, you know, the talent that they have in place there, feels more comfortable to get those looks, that reason that he gave me 2.5 years ago doesn't hold up anymore. Well, let's move on to the last team in the ACC, Notre Dame, the Fighting Irish, who have their own kind of set of issues to address that I don't want to say are unique or different, but, you know, they've really only had to replace a goalie 3 times in the Jerry Byrne defensive coordinator era since, I believe, 2008. And this is, you know, one of those seasons where we'll see a changing of the guard from John Kemp to Connor Kelly. And I got an opportunity, like I said at the top, to see the Fighting Irish when they were out in Colorado Springs at the end of their fall break, take on the Air Force Falcons. And, you know, quite notably, they didn't look good. They didn't practice at all that week, so there are certainly reasons or excuses for it. They also had played Michigan in Chicago earlier in the fall, so maybe there wasn't as much of a point of emphasis or a sense of urgency associated with this fall scrimmage. We'll talk about Air Force in a later podcast. They looked good, so don't get me wrong on that. But, you know, I didn't think, for example, Connor Kelly was at all to blame for the loss. I actually thought he looked pretty good, particularly early, as I believe the Falcons built like a 4-2 lead, something like that, in the first quarter. It was, I think, 4-1 Notre Dame scored for the first time, I think, moments before the end of the first quarter. But, you know, defensively, a lot more sliding upfield than you typically see out of Notre Dame, so it was kind of a lack of communication, I thought, there. You know, bringing back 2 starters, but different roles. Everybody got promoted a little bit. Stephen O'Hara takes on that Matt Miller role, whereas previously he'd kind of been the ground ball guy. Now he's kind of the main cover, interior cover coordinator guy. Buglione, who was kind of the crease guy, biggest guy last year, I think he'll be covering the number 2. And then Matt Landis, although we might see that matchup change a little bit. Notre Dame doesn't care about matchups, but you might see Landis be a little bit more of a match feed type player. So Buglione might stay with the bigger attackman going forward. But, you know, some interesting issues coming out of there. In your conversations or your readings, is there anything in particular about Notre Dame that struck out to you in the fall?
Two things. One was that the 8.31 goals against they gave up last year, which some coaches would be doing somersaults about. That was Notre Dame's highest since 05, the year before Byrne got there. The opponent shooting percentage, 26.9%, was the opponent's highest since 2002. And I think those are clearly things that Notre Dame is going to have to address because their schedule is not getting any easier. You know, sort of going into the ACC, that's going to, you know, it's not going south, it's going north. Your schedule, SOS. So I'm curious to see what they do in terms of two-way defensemen. The match feet, you say, I think they're going to run into a world of a little bit quicker attackmen, and I do think Landis is going to play a pretty big role for them. Long stick middies look good. I think they really are going to emphasize short stick middies who can move. That's been a strength of theirs in the past. I don't think it was last year, and I suspect that they are going to get back to having the two-way D-midi, O-midi types, and they certainly have the athletes who can do it. I know that their recruiting class coming in is high school seniors this year is very good. So I would say that the future is very bright for Notre Dame. One last tidbit on Notre Dame, a useless stat, but in the last 8 years, they've lost to the eventual national champion in the NCAA tournament 6 times. So they're not missing by that much. You know, the teams they lose to generally are not teams that aren't very good. Right. You know, they generally lose to the very best. And at some point, they're going to have to get over that hump, obviously. But I think that they are not far.
It's interesting. I don't remember which coach it was, but in my travels to practices, talking about Notre Dame, the first thing one coach said is, like, don't they just breed All-America goalies over there? So it doesn't really matter that they're replacing, you know, such a great goaltender. You know, Notre Dame kind of has one of those vibes among the team that I don't care who the individuals are on the defense or in goal, they're going to be one of the best defenses in the land.
Well, and to a degree, I think that's true offensively as well. I mean, Matt Kavanaugh is probably the biggest name to play offense for Notre Dame in the last 5 years. You know, whether it was David Earl or Zach Brenneman or Ryan Hoff or Westy Hopkins or, you know, any of these guys that have had big seasons, I don't think any of them was as singularly big as Kavanaugh. And one of the things that I noticed out of, you know, that Air Force scrimmage is that they weren't working to get Kavanaugh involved. It wasn't as if they were showcasing him. He got 3, I believe, but they were in the course of the game. One was off of a restart where he beat his man, you know, from about 40 yards out, finished on the run. It was a nice play, but it'll be, you know, I don't expect Notre Dame to change their offensive philosophy. I don't expect them to ever really change any of their philosophies, but I certainly don't expect them to change their offensive philosophy on the basis of the fact that they had, you know, a 50-point guy as a freshman. One other note that I want to get to on the Fighting Irish. You know, one of the things that I like to pay special attention to or kind of, you know, modulate expectations after the fall is, were there any freshmen that seemed like if you were going to redo the recruiting rankings right now would have made a big jump? And Sergio Perkovic, the freshman midfielder out of Brother Rice in Michigan, who was, I believe, a wide receiver for the Warriors, really impressed me. They let him play. He's tall. He's like 6'3", 6'4". They let him play a lot of defense, which impressed me more than his offense. But they also let him shoot a lot. So he's one of those guys that I expect to be on the field a fair amount, you know, assuming he stays healthy and doesn't make too many drastic mistakes. And the type of guy that, you know, you could, who knows, he could be, you know, a goal-a-game type guy, not necessarily blow the block score out of the water, but be a lot more valuable than that. One of the other thing I just wanted to touch on as it pertains to the ACC is this idea of the schedule that we've talked about a couple of times. And one thing that I think probably 6-for-6 coaches, and Christian, you talk to all of them, so you can say it's better than either Matt or I, but I feel like they all harbor this sense or harbor this idea that they could go 0-5 in the league and still, like, I think every single one of them believes that it's feasible their team could go 0-5 in the league, and if they were to do that, they could still be having a pretty decent season.
Oh, no question.
So, what do you make of that phenomenon that, like, the it's not so much that the league is competitive, it's that the gap between the first and last place team is so narrow, which is the same thing as being competitive, but I don't know. There's a distinction in my brain that I hope you share because that's the question I'm asking.
No, I do. The way I understand it, the ACC tournament is at PPL Park this year, and the semifinals are Friday night, but the 5-6 game, I think, is Saturday, and then Sunday is the ACC title game. Like, that's a pretty good weekend of lacrosse. You're going to see some very good games in that weekend. And from what I think I have this correct, that the 5-6 game counts against the participation, the NCAA participation, whereas the semifinals and finals don't. So I thought that that was kind of an interesting dynamic for the 1 year that they're going to have those six great teams in that league. I mean, I can't wait to see these games. Syracuse, someone asked me what's going to happen this year. I said, all I know is that the Syracuse-Carolina game is going to be 24-22, and I don't know who's going to win. But I think it's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
All right, well, and like I said at the top, the last thing we'll get to on this part one of the Inside Lacrosse Fall Ball Recap podcast is the new programs, Furman, Richmond, BU, and Monmouth, making their debut in 2014. I wrote all four of those write-ups for Face Off Yearbook, got an opportunity to talk to all four of those coaches, and one of the things that struck out to me that was interesting is the unique challenges that each one faces, and, you know, just quickly running down the list, it's both a challenge and the way in which they're tailoring their approach. So for Furman, I think that, you know, their geographic remoteness coupled with the relatively rich resources that they had, plus the goal of adding the lacrosse team, meant that they were going to carry a very big roster. So they had 59 guys throughout the fall. Richie Mead told me that he put together a depth chart that had 38 guys on it, which means there were 21 that weren't. And he said that, you know, what he liked about it was the clarity of conversation that it promoted, meaning that the 21 guys that weren't on the depth chart, they aren't going to get cut this year. He made a promise that nobody was going to get cut this year. But they know that they have to work to get on the depth chart. And for the guys that are on the depth chart, they need to work to move up or down. And I kind of, you know, I think that Richie took a lot of heat for taking that many players, particularly that many freshmen. But, you know, if that's the approach, at least it seems to me like trying to be as clear as possible about where you stand going forward is the best that you can make of that situation.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously Richie knows a thing or two about carrying a big roster, you know, from his years at Navy. And, you know, and I saw some of the heat you're referring to. You know, he's getting slammed in the message boards for lying to these kids and giving them false hope. But, you know, it sounds like, you know, he has the depth chart clearly communicated. And if you think of it the other way, he's giving, you know, these 50-some guys a chance to play Division I lacrosse who probably
wouldn't have otherwise.
So he's clearly communicating that. You know, it seems to be a strategy that for an upstart program, you need numbers. That's, you know, the reality of it is you're not dealing with, you know, I can just have a few good guys. You need as many guys as you can, you know, to kind of build that mentality and just have them in practice and everything. So more power to them.
And not to mention the fact that, you know, every year you see guys that just get better. The more guys that you have in your roster, the more opportunity you have for one of those guys who is destined to get better being on your squad and becoming a contributor. So we'll see whether or not that's something that happens for Furman moving forward. Richmond was an interesting team to me insofar as the way that they tried to meld their club program into the varsity program while, you know, being probably the school that was most on the tongue of people that talked about adding Division I programs. Richmond was always a mid-sized private school, not too far away from the, you know, mid-Atlantic lacrosse hotbeds. That was a destination for a lot of those schools. It has a successful FCS football team, which I think helps in terms of keeping its athletic profile high, while at the same time not necessarily siphoning off too much of what a lacrosse program needs to be successful. And all of that, you know, kind of like collated to make Richmond a team that I think a lot of people expected not only should have lacrosse, but one of the reasons it should have lacrosse is because they could potentially be good. So it was interesting to talk to Dan Shimani throughout the fall, a couple times at the beginning, a couple times at the end, and get his sense. His approach, in contrast to Coach Meade's, was really dramatic, where, you know, Furman started with a lot of conditioning and really eased into playing lacrosse. My sense is that Richmond was playing pretty high-level lacrosse immediately, and the approach, like I said, was a lot different. And I'm not saying that, depending on the results this year, one of those approaches was better or worse. You know, it was certainly a choice made by each staff, and we'll see, you know, how it kind of manifests itself. But you got an opportunity to see them, Christian, in D.C. What was your thoughts about how competitive they were? I believe they played Towson and Georgetown?
They played Towson and Georgetown. I was actually just looking through my notes. By my count, against Towson, who, remember, made the NCAA tournament last year, Richmond was ahead 2-1 at the end of the first quarter and 6-4 at halftime. And you mentioned Perkovic as a freshman to watch. I really liked Mitch Goldberg, the freshman attackman from Bullis. And having the following weekend, I was up at Landon School for the George Priority event, and the Landon coaches there saying, Goldberg's a really good player. Like, he had really caught their eye as a player at Bullis. He's tall. You know, he's a big kid. He's skinny, but he's big. And I think that You know, certainly Richmond got Towson's attention pretty quickly. Now Towson was without Thomas DiNapoli, who's a great attackman and does a lot of things, almost in a Holman-type player for them. But, you know, still, for a first-year program, I think I was very impressed. And one of the other things I noticed about Richmond was as they were leaving the field after having scrimmaged Towson, I mean, Shamadi, just everyone wanted to go up and talk to him and shake his hand and say congrats. I mean, even though they wound up, you know, quote-unquote losing that scrimmage, Towson came back to win. But people were clearly very impressed with what they saw from Richmond. And poor Shamadi, he kept saying hi to so many people that the team had to do their drills before the next game without him. You know, he was just, everyone wanted to shake his hand or pat him on the back for how good they had looked.
Yeah, and certainly at that point, you know, this was more than a month ago now, so, you know, things could have changed. But I think their defense looked pretty solid and a lot further along than his offense did at that point in the fall.
And exactly, going back to your point, they have that very good goalie coming in from Woodbury Forest, Benny Pugh, and he had really caught my eye. I've seen him a couple times in high school, big kid, 6'4", good athlete, and he did not start that Towson scrimmage. He played the second half. So if he's, you know, and I'm not going to read too much into it, maybe I don't know what Dan's point was with the goalies, but if he's the second string goalie entering the season, the starter is going to be really good because Benny Pugh is a really good goalie.
Yeah, and truthfully, just I think, you know, Monmouth had two goalies in the fall. They have lost one. They're trying to look to add one in mid-year. But otherwise, all four of them basically said, we don't have a starter. You know, off the record, if we had to go today, this might be the guy that we would go with. But, you know, that certainly doesn't mean that's who we're going to go with in game two. So, goalie situation as it pertains to these four teams, not something that I would want to speculate on. Moving forward down the track, BU, you know, Ryan Pulley is the one guy that I haven't had an opportunity to catch up with since fall ball has been over. I'm actually hoping to do that today or tomorrow. But the, you know, the Terriers certainly joined the Patriot League, probably have the tallest test in terms of their schedule. You know, eight games against high-quality opponents, established programs. But on the flip side, you know, I think that because of the fact that they, you know, they're getting one of, you know, part and parcel of adding the program was adding a facility, a practice field, which is a big thing. Certainly, you know, their proximity to a lot of, you know, great talent in the, you know, Massachusetts area, as well as, you know, their funding, what they're able to do in terms of scholarships, the success of the hockey program, you know, what they're able to do and offer academically. I think the BU is pretty well positioned to be very competitive. You know, Christian, you can speak to this. Out of all of the players that are on these four rosters, you know, Ralph DiAgostino was a Syracuse transfer at Furman who was a defenseman on the U.S. U19 team. He might be the best player on these four teams. But the one that I would maybe bet on, maybe being the best player long term, is Patrick Myers, B's attackman out of Gonzaga.
Yeah, sure, big tall kid.
Yeah, what do you think of, you know, I guess, well, I don't want to put you on the spot in terms of what your thoughts are on you know, one of a fellow Purple Eagle, but what are your, you know, any thoughts on BU, anything that you heard about coming out of the scuttlebutt, or any thoughts on Patrick Myers?
Well, certainly Myers, people at Gonzaga thought that he was a really good player and that some of the college programs missed the boat on him, and I will say that he scored a lot of big goals for the Eagles, too. I think Georgetown Prep, when the first time they'd ever beaten Georgetown Prep 2 years ago, Myers had two. It was a 4-3 game, and I think he scored at least two of the goals. Extra man player, you know, good shooter, big tall kid. I think he's a pretty good player.
And then finally, Monmouth, you know, the Hawks having a little bit more trouble with numbers, I think, to some degree than the other three programs. But talking to Coach Fisher, certainly sounds like they had kind of nailed that out by the time the season started. Similar in terms of having a little bit of club presence on their roster. You know, being in, you know, not as competitive a conference as the Patriot League, certainly, you know, have an opportunity to kind of be a little bit, get their feet wet a little bit better might be the best way of putting it. But, you know, one of the things that impressed me about, you know, what Coach Fish said in terms of how they kind of developed over the course of the fall was that just, it's more of a comment on the idea of, you know, the expansion of Division I lacrosse. You know, he made the comment that we could have filled our roster 10 times over in terms of the amount of interest that we had. And that the players that he brought in were coming from programs that, you know, were really, really highly respected programs that, you know, you see dotting rosters at Duke and you know, any of the other, you know, top 10 competitive programs. And I think that, you know, that's a foundation that was interesting to me in terms of how they were going to build on. Whereas, you know, you look at Furman's roster, you see a little bit more geographic diversity. You know, you look at Monmouth's roster and you see a lot of programs that have won state championships, you know, guys like, you know, places like Janesville, DeWitt, Haverford, you know, LaSalle, Obviously, a lot of New Jersey presence as well. It was, you know, just kind of interesting, again, to see the approach when it comes to, you know, a first-year program, the latest in the game, to some degree, obviously, Richmond being announced later, but, you know, to get things up and running and also get their coaching situation figured out. You know, it'll be wild to see, you know, how the Hawks settle into this season.
And, you know, they have a lot of potential, like you said, with the conference. You know, they have a lot of potential to compete in that conference pretty quickly. You know, especially where they're located, you know, have kind of just that, you know, really high-level talent in that New Jersey area that, you know, might be overshadowed by the big programs in terms of, you know, some of the New York guys and Maryland guys. But those New Jersey guys, you know, if they want to stay local, you know, Monmouth really can tap into that market and be successful.
All right, well, that's going to do it for part one of the Inside Lacrosse Fall Ball Look Back podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. We are going to come back at you momentarily with we're going to talk about the Big East and the future Big Ten.
Inside Lacrosse podcast.